The North Carolina Reading Service presents this program for blind and print-impaired audience. John Federson here reading The Indie Week. This issue dated June the 23rd of 2023. IndieWeek.com is the main source of all our articles today, as the print edition appears not to be showing up on the newsstands where I usually look for it. But the IndieWeek.com is more up-to-date in any event. And we'll start with an item by Clayton Henkel from NC Newsline about Duke University. One of the biggest financial worries for parents of high school-age children is whether they can afford to send their child to college. Duke University erased that worry for some families on Tuesday in announcing that starting this fall, the university would provide full tuition grants for its undergraduate students admitted from North and South Carolina who with family incomes of $150,000 or less. Full tuition grants. If a family income is below a $65,000 threshold, Duke plans to provide not just full tuition, but housing, meals, and some course materials. The idea being those students will not need to take out student loans. For an idea of how significant this is, the cost of Duke tuition for the 23-24 academic year, tuition alone, $63,450 a year. So, the President Vincent Price, in a Tuesday press release, says this additional financial support for undergrads reflects Duke's commitment to our students from the Carolinas by providing even more equitable access to a Duke education and ensuring students have the resources they need to truly thrive. While here at Duke, we will also make our campus community stronger. For current undergraduates from the Carolinas, they too will be eligible for additional financial assistance from the school starting in the fall semester. Officials project that about 340 current students are expected to benefit in the next academic year. Gary Bennett is the dean of Duke's Trinity College of Arts and Sciences. He notes that equitable access to higher education can change the trajectory of the student and their family for decades. Dean Bennett said, attending college can expand a family's opportunities for generations, and we aim to make the Duke experience as widely accessible as we can. For the current academic year, more than 1,100 North Carolina residents from 65 counties were enrolled as undergraduates. Bennett said, retaining talent is critical to our region's success. Duke's commitment to these students is also a commitment to the North and South Carolina communities they call home. In subsequent years, Duke is anticipating that the new offer will attract more students from the Carolinas. Over the next 5 years, Duke is planning to invest an additional $6 million to $7 million per year to provide the increased assistance. The largesse by Duke University comes at a time some state lawmakers are proposing know-before-you-go legislation, in which high school students have a clearer understanding of their post-secondary education choices and their professional futures before they take on debt and head off to college. North Carolina's average borrower carries more than $37,000 of student loan debt. And this article closes with a closer look at the annual undergraduate college costs for some of North Carolina's universities and colleges for next school year, 23-24. Tuition and fees for Wake Forest University, $64,700. Davidson College tuition and student activity fees, $60,000. High Point University, tuition and fees, $46,500. This is for 1 year. tuition and fees at Elon University, $44,500. North Carolina State University, state tuition and fees, about $9,000. Out-of-state fees, about $32,000. And UNC Chapel Hill, in-state tuition, $8,700. Out-of-state, $39,000 plus. East Carolina, in-state, $7,000. Out-of-state, $23,000. And Elizabeth City State University charges in tuition and fees, $3,300. And out-of-state, $7,300. Now, it mentions also in these all of these little fees that housing and food expenses can add, you bet they can, more than thousands more beyond the yearly cost of tuition and fees. And I'll move right into an article that I was unable to read in back in May. This was written by Dwayne Ballin and submitted May 10th. And it's about college athletes making money off endorsements. Could they be paid as university employees next? During spring practice, this begins, UNC's Chapel Hill star quarterback Drake May rises at 5:45 a.m. Each breakfast, attends a short football meeting and participates in drills until 10:30. He races to get to his first class by 11 and finishes with another class at 1:30. He attends a series of football meetings in the afternoon, including watching video of games and practice, and typically finishes at 7 p.m. His father, Mark May, a former UNC quarterback who described this schedule to The Assembly, where this article first appeared, "This is a long day." May has three other sons who played or still play college sports, including former UNC basketball standout Luke May. "I've really come around to the idea that they are more like employees. College athletes are considered amateurs, but they are the essential components of what has become a multi-billion-dollar entertainment enterprise. As coaches, administrators, and TV executives made more and more money from college football and men's basketball, various college athletes laid the legal groundwork for why they should be paid for their labor, but none of those lawsuits fundamentally changed the business. That is, until 2021, when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled unanimously that college athletes could be paid by outside sources for use of their name, image, and likeness, essentially for endorsements. Judge Brett Kavanaugh was blunt in his concurring opinion, quote, "The NCAA business model would be flatly illegal in almost any other industry in America," he wrote. The NCAA, the governing body of college sport, had built, quote, "a massive money-raising enterprise on the backs of student athletes who are not fairly compensated." Since then, some college stars have signed lucrative deals. The mother of Armando Bacot, a UNC Chapel Hill basketball star and business major, told Sports Illustrated last year that her son was set to earn more than $500,000 in 2022. Drake may have turned down a lot more than that. At a press conference in December, UNC football coach Mac Brown said that May, quote, "was offered a lot of money to go to another program, which is against NCAA rules." University of Pittsburgh coach Pat Narduzzi said then that two schools offered May $5 million, presumably in endorsement deals, to transfer. Narduzzi was complaining on a talk radio show about the new rules that allow players to transfer every year. He told Sports Illustrated, Brown did, "We're the mini NFL. That's where we're headed. We'll never see amateurism again. It's gone. I hate it." With all this money flowing to star players, college sports fans might have assumed that compensation for athletes was a settled issue. Far from it. The biggest, thorniest, most polarizing matter lies ahead. Marketing and advertising deals available to college athletes don't include compensation from the universities themselves. The next evolutionary step is becoming more and more likely, treating college athletes as employees and compensating them accordingly. In December, the Los Angeles region of the National Labor Relations Board, the NLRB, found merit in an unfair labor practice charge filed on behalf of University of Southern California football and basketball players seeking recognition as university employees. The NLRB said the university, the Pac-12 Conference, and the NCAA had, quote, misclassified scholarship basketball and football players as mere student athletes rather than employees entitled to protections under the law. The issue will be heard by a federal administrative law judge and ultimately could be appealed in federal court. Could be. And the NLRB's Chicago office previously found that Northwestern University football players spend 1,700 hours a year on football, an average of 36 hours a week. They spend 50 to 60 hours a week during August preseason, 40 to 50 during the season, and 12 to 25 hours in the spring. In that case, the Chicago office said the Northwestern players should be considered employees, but the full NLRB declined in 2015 to assert jurisdiction. Some analysts believe the full NLRB will decide to hear the Southern Cal case. The NLRB only has jurisdiction over private employers, including private universities such as Southern Cal. But if the players win, the NCAA would be forced to address the issue for public universities also. Jay Billis, the ESPN analyst, lawyer, and former Duke University basketball player, is unequivocal that college athletes should be paid as employees. Quote, right now they fit every criteria you would have in an employee. They're under the dominion and control of the university. They're told when to play and when not to. To me, it's very clear. Wake Forest University law professor Timothy Davis, one of the nation's leading authorities on sports law, views the issue as a question of fairness. He said advocates for athletes, as well as the public, see the enormous amount of revenue that is generated by college sports, primarily men's basketball and football. They think it's unfair, out of balance. The sense is they should share in some of the revenue. The money keeps growing. Athletic departments for Division I schools, the highest level of college sports, make money from ticket sales, royalties and licensing, donor contributions, and student fees. But the biggest source is revenue from media rights, which includes television and digital streaming. The NCAA, which draws nearly all its income from a media rights deal for the NCAA men's basketball tournament, receives $1 billion annually for March Madness. Most of that money goes to the universities. Same with the college football playoff, which is separate from the NCAA. It's expected to secure a new deal with an expanded 12-team field for nearly $2.2 billion per year. The Atlantic Coast Conference, ACC, has a media rights deal worth roughly $500,000 per year. That's considerably less than Big Ten's new seven-year deal for $7 billion. Three of North Carolina's four ACC schools, UNC, Duke, and NC State, have annual athletic revenues of more than $100 million. Wake Forest University has $85 million. For purposes of comparison, Ohio State University generates the most nationally, with $250 million for the 21-22 fiscal year. College administrators feel the pressure to change, but they don't want to. Paying athletes would disrupt their business model, especially if they had to compensate athletes in every sport. UNC, for example, has 28 varsity sports. If all college athletes had to be paid, some universities might cut sports, both men's and women's. The federal law called Title IX, requires universities to treat male and female athletes equally. But it's unclear that that law would apply if football and men's basketball were paid from revenues generated from their sports. Those are the only two sports that typically make money. In a recent article in the New York Times, University of Notre Dame's president and athletics director urged Congress to block athletes from being considered employees. Reverend John Jenkins and Jack Swarbrick wrote, "College athletics is a treasured national institution. Professionalizing teams, treating athletes more as employees than as students, and weakening the vital connection with the educational mission of their colleges will rob college athletics of its special character." Traditionalists agree. If college athletes become employees, they'd fall into the same wage and hour guidelines as everyone else, said State Labor Commissioner Josh Dobson. They'd have to make the minimum wage of 7 1/4 an hour, and would get overtime pay when they worked more than 40 hours a week. But Dobson hopes that doesn't happen. Quote, "There's something majestic in college sports to me that makes it special, unique." He's a college sports junkie who roots for Appalachian State University. "If you go down that road, I think there's the potential to dilute college sports." Supporters of the status quo view the athlete-university relationship as a partnership. In exchange for a scholarship, an athlete gets the chance to compete at a high level, often with good coaching and in good facilities, and potentially become a professional or an Olympic athlete. Former NC basketball star Debbie Antonelli, who served as director of marketing for Ohio State Athletics and is now a college basketball TV analyst, says, "People have viewed it as a one-way street, that we've held the athletes down. I don't think we've done that at all." In the 1990s, Louis Perkins played tennis at NC Central and was an academic All-American. Now he's the athletics director there. Quote, "Being a student athlete in modern times, yes, it's a job. But Perkins doesn't know how he would pay athletes in 15 varsity sports. That's not an option. He's working with a tight $12 million budget. The wealthier athletic programs like those in the ACC might be able to pay athletes, but schools with smaller budgets are nowhere near ready for this," he said. "It will further separate the haves from the have-nots." John Curry, Wake Forest director of athletics, said he doesn't consider playing a college sport to be work. And he said Wake could not afford to pay players without cutting other parts of the athletic budget. But he said college administrators need to recognize the public has long viewed the athletes as employees, and that change is coming. Billis, the former Duke player, is unmoved by the nostalgia some feel toward the amateur model. Quote, "Amateurism doesn't do anything for the athlete, doesn't make them a better athlete, person, or student. It just means the school has total control, and they don't have to come out of pocket with regards to anything in the way of payment. I've always thought that was wrong, to the point of being immoral." The U.S. Court of Appeals Third Circuit in Philadelphia heard oral arguments on January 18th for the case Johnson versus NCAA. Trey Johnson, a former Villanova football player, argued under the Fair Labor Standards Act, Division I athletes are employees and thus entitled to minimum wage and overtime pay. The three-judge panel did not appear swayed by the NCAA's core principle that athletes shouldn't be paid. A decision is expected later this year. Increasingly, this debate is shifting to how compensation would work. How much would the athletes be paid? Would they get overtime? Would they be eligible for a retirement plan? Could a coach fire an underperforming player? The day after the lawyers argued in Philadelphia, California State Representative Chris Holden introduced the College Athlete Protection Act. Holden, who played basketball at San Diego State University, spoke with reporters outside the historic Rose Bowl Stadium in Pasadena. This bill calls for football and men's basketball players in California to be paid up to $25,000 annually. Colleges would also be required to cover the cost of athletic scholarships for 6 years and pay medical expenses for college sports injuries even after graduation. Some envision a hybrid form of compensation for the profitable sports, football and men's basketball. Amy Perko, CEO of the nonprofit Knight Commission on Intercollegiate Athletics, and a former Wake Forest basketball player, envisions treating athletes like medical school residents. She said they're under contract, being paid a salary, but they're still part of the educational mission. Non-revenue sports could be preserved through student fees or direct financial support from the university, said Holden Thorpe, a former chancellor at UNC Chapel Hill. Quote, all the Division II and III universities are paying for sports, and you never hear that some faculty at a D2 school got upset about the cost of the athletics program, said Thorpe, who was the provost of Washington University in St. Louis, which is in Division III. DeWayne Washington was an NC State football star in the early 1990s, then had a 12-year NFL career, and now serves on that school's board of trustees. He's concerned that the player-coach relationship would change to an employee-boss dynamic. But overall, he said, paying college players wouldn't be bad, just different. Over time, we'd get used to it, he said. The train is moving. I don't think you can stop it. We've got to have some guardrails so we don't fall off. The next part of this is called the Duke Model. David Grenardo had been waiting for this moment for 6 years. Few people have given as much thought as how college could pay athletes as the former Rice University football player. He said, could it be done? Absolutely. It happens every single day in all the industries in the United States. There's plenty of money to go around. Grenardo graduated in 2002 from the Duke Law School. In 2017, when he was teaching at another law school, he published a paper called The Duke Model that laid out a statistics-based system for compensating college football and men's basketball players. He is now a professor at the University of St. Thomas Law School in Minneapolis. Duke University has not endorsed Grenardo's plan and declined comment for this article. The Duke Model features tiered payments based on playing time and bonuses for outstanding performance. Grenardo says it could be adapted for any college sport, men's and women's. It includes base compensation derived from playing time and bonuses for athletic and academic performance. Conferences would determine how much money was available to compensate athletes and would set limits on pay to maintain competitive balance. Each school would submit its financial data to the NCAA. The base compensation for football players in the largest conferences like the ACC, who start every game, would be $40,000. Players who led the team in various statistical categories, passing, rushing, tackles, interception, would receive a $5,000 bonus per category. Players who received all-conference or all-American honors also would receive a bonus, as would teams who won postseason games. A star running back could receive $40,000 in base compensation, $10,000 in bonuses for leading his team in two categories, $22,500 for individual honors, and $9,500 for a team success, for a total of $82,000. Grenardo calculated that a backup player could make $29,500. The total for a team with one first-team All-American that made it to the semifinal round of the playoffs would be less than $2.5 million. Grenardo wrote in his paper that that kind of season would reap millions of dollars in revenue for the university, some of which should be allocated to pay the players for achieving those successes for the school. He wrote that universities can't afford to pay their players. One option, they could reallocate coaching salaries. He used the University of Kentucky basketball program as an example. In men's basketball, the base compensation would be based on minutes played. A player who averaged 35 minutes a game would receive $35,000. Players who led the team in scoring, rebounding, block shots, or steals would get a $5,000 bonus. As in football, there would be bonuses for individual honors and team success. Granado calculated that a basketball team that won its conference championship and made it to the Final Four with a National Player of the Year and two all-conference players would have a total compensation of $571,800. In 2017, Kentucky's men's basketball coach John Calipari had a salary of $7.4 million. Granado said, the incentives align with the players. The more they play, the more they get paid. It aligns for the coaches as well. They want the players to want to play more, and they want to play the best players. He said even smaller athletic departments could figure out a way to reallocate money to pay their athletes, he said. Granado's plan compensates football and men's basketball. If universities had to meet Title IX requirements, they could spend an amount equal to that compensation on women's sports, which, he wrote, could lead to a significant increase in spending on women's college athletics. Yes, indeed. Granado pushed back when asked if a system like this could lead to issues with team chemistry and jealousy. Players wouldn't be just competing for playing time, they'd be competing for pay. He said, all those issues are nonsensical to me. I'm not going to play worse and jeopardize my playing time to make somebody else look worse. He believes paying college players is inevitable. He says that universities should take the initiative to adopt a model like his before something else, possibly more expensive, is forced upon them by Congress or the U.S. Justice Department. He also has published a free market plan in which students would compensate athletes based on their market value, although teams would have a salary cap to maintain competitive balance. And he said, all I care about is eventually they start getting paid. All right, over to Jasmine Gallup's column from Raleigh. The Raleigh City Council has approved a rezoning request from Shaw University. This is a Dateline just a day or two ago. Plans to expand and redevelop the Shaw campus will move forward this year after the City Council approved the rezoning request Tuesday in a 5-3 vote. That split vote brings a temporary halt to months of heated debate between Shaw alumni who are concerned about the future of the historically black college and administrators who say welcoming private developers onto campus is the only way for the school to survive. The plan includes leasing some land on campus to developers who could build new apartment or office buildings up to 30 stories high to bring a much-needed influx of cash to the school. The possibility of new commercial construction on campus worries some alumni and nearby residents, though, who are concerned it could erase the college's history and eventually the institution itself. The neighborhood has already experienced rapid gentrification. Still, Shaw University's land in downtown Raleigh is its best resource, valued at between $160 and $270 million as of 2019, according to a report from the Assembly. Shaw President Paulette Dillard says the redevelopment will include campus improvements to serve students, such as a new research center, urgent care facility, or library. In an attempt to assuage concerns, the university attached an additional condition to its rezoning request this week. Any new development is now required to include housing for students. The vote on Shaw's rezoning was decided by City Council newcomer Jane Harrison, who was elected alongside three other new members in November. Her fellow newcomers, Mary Black, Megan Patton, and Christina Jones, each voted against the rezoning. The three votes alone weren't enough to overrule those of Mayor Pro Tem Corey Branch, who made the motion to approve, Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin, who seconded, and established council members Jonathan Melton and Stormy Forte, who each voted in favor. Branch said, I don't come at this lightly because I think this is a very emotional case for so many people at so many levels. With that said, I've come to my conclusion on where I would like to move this. The vote that followed was unclear, with council members Melton and Forte raising their hands only slightly. and audience members applauding at one point as they thought the rezoning had failed. Harrison appeared hesitant to cast her yes vote. When she did eventually speak, it was after a long pause and a comforting gesture from Baldwin. She was visibly emotional as she said, "I've just got to say a couple things. I want to thank everyone that's here. This has been the absolute hardest case that has come to us. I care about what you all bring to the table. You have affected what this case looks like. You have affected me." Like many other council members who voted in favor, she said her decision wasn't easy, citing the many points of view. She also read a letter from a former advisory council chair, Francis Williams, about the Prince Hall Historic Overlay District. During the rezoning process, many residents argued that approving the request would endanger several historic buildings on and near campus, including Rogers Bagley Daniels Pegues House and the Charles Fraser House, located in the nearby Prince Hall Historic Overlay District. University leaders pushed back, saying they had never wanted to be included in the district in the first place, an argument that was backed up by Williams' statement. Williams' letter also mentioned how many property owners had not wanted to be included in the district, but said removing themselves from it turned into a contentious and burdensome process. Harrison said, "I only read this letter to share just one other opinion that happens to be out there. We have received hundreds. I don't see this as a win-win-win-win. I want all the communities to be a part of this." She went on to say she's putting her hope in the idea that Shaw University will continue to work with the community to reach an agreement, specifically on plans for the campus mosque, which has been closed since March of 2020, even after the campus chapel reopened its door following the COVID pandemic. Community members, however, find that unlikely. The council decision was met with boos, criticism, and widespread skepticism that Shaw would take any action to include community input. Despite that, plans to reshape the campus will go ahead. As a result of public pressure, the university did add nearly 20 conditions to the rezoning request, rules it will have to follow when construction begins. Significantly, those conditions include a requirement to hold community meetings once a quarter for the next 3 years, a requirement to rezone any property that is sold, although Shaw says it won't sell any of its property, and the requirement that one of the first three new buildings must include housing for Shaw students. The university has also agreed to allow an independent third party to check if the university's historic buildings are impacted by construction. Readings from vibration-sensitive equipment will be sent out for review. And next, from Jeffrey Billman, originally published online at the Assembly. On Sunday, former Apex Town Council member Scott Lassiter filed a lawsuit accusing House Speaker Tim Moore of carrying on a years-long affair with his wife, Jamie Lassiter, the director of the North Carolina Conference of Clerks of Superior Court. The lawsuit's full of juicy allegations from the salacious. Moore convinced Mrs. Lassiter to engage in degrading sexual acts with him, including group activity, to potential abuses of power. For example, Scott Lassiter says his wife would not end the affair, quote, for fear of retaliation, that Moore dangled political favors to smooth things over after being confronted about the relationship, that Moore had sex, quote, with others over whom he had power or influence, and that Moore conspired with an unknown person to place spy cameras on the Lassiter's property. Lots to unpack there. For now, though, let's focus on the anachronisms under which Moore and about 200 North Carolinians will likely be sued this year: alienation of affection and criminal conversation. The former refers to a defendant's wrongful and malicious conduct, i.e., initiating an affair, that disrupted a loving marital relationship. The latter has only two requirements. A couple was married, and one of them had sex with a defendant. The fact that the affair was consensual is irrelevant. Both so-called Hartbaum torts are drawn from the common law, quote, belief that a husband owned his wife and was entitled to compensation for lost property interest in her sexual fidelity, as H. Hunter Bruton explained in the Duke Law Journal in 2016. Not laws passed by the General Assembly. And until 1897 and 1925, North Carolina women couldn't bring alienation of affection and criminal conversation lawsuits, respectively. Only aggrieved husbands could. Almost every state allowed these Hartbaum torts 200 years ago, but since the 1930s, they've all but vanished. Mississippi, Hawaii, South Dakota, and Utah are the only other states that permit alienation of affection claims, while Hawaii, Kansas, and Maine are the only others that allow criminal conversation cases. The NC Court of Appeals declared them unconstitutional in 1984, but the state Supreme Court overruled that decision months later. Verdicts resulting in windfalls for the cuckolded followed. $1 million in 1999, $1.5 million in 2004, almost $6 million in 2010, and $30 million in 2014. The torts fans point out that while they were rooted in misogyny, women now bring about half of these lawsuits. They also argue the lawsuits, quote, deter conduct that causes personal injury. They protect promises made during the marriage, and they help preserve the institution of marriage, which provides innumerable benefits to our society, wrote Winston-Salem attorney G. Edgar Parker in the Bar Journal in 2019. There's little evidence that that's true. North Carolina has the country's 12th highest divorce rate. Mississippi and Utah rank 9th and 11th, respectively. Few non-lawyers realize they can be sued for sleeping with a married person. More people are probably aware that judges can factor in adultery when calculating alimony, and that doesn't seem to stop people from cheating. Deterrence is beside the point, argued Judge Darren Jackson from the Court of Appeals last year. Quote, disincentivizing people from choosing to engage in these relationships by treating a person as the property of another person is wrong and has no place in our world or society today. The law must not validate the idea that sex is something a person can owe another person, and by extension, something that a third person could possibly steal. Jackson, a former Democratic lawmaker, was a lone dissenter in Beavers versus McMicken, which focused on whether a man had provided enough evidence that the defendant was his former spouse's lover for his lawsuit to go to trial. Jackson thought he hadn't, but most of his 28-page dissent, nearly twice as long as the court's opinion, ripped the antiquated torts that he believed lack any adequate modern justification for existence. Of course, unlike most Hartbaum tort defendants, Tim Moore presumably knew these lawsuits were possible before engaging in the alleged affair with Jamie Lassiter. Besides being a lawyer, he's been in the General Assembly for 20 years, the last 8 as Speaker. During that time, the NC Association of Women Attorneys, the Bar Association's Family Law Section, and other advocates lobbied the legislature to abolish alienation of affection and criminal conversation litigation. Moore's colleagues have repeatedly introduced legislation to do just that, most recently on April 17th, to no avail. The bills have always died in committee. If true, Scott Lassiter's allegations that Moore has used his office to coerce sex are serious, but so is this. Lassiter's effort to publicly humiliate his wife, an act of petty vengeance, is fully sanctioned by North Carolina courts. On top of that, Lassiter believes that he should be paid because his wife had sex with another man, and that belief, too, is state-sanctioned. Jackson wrote last year, our Supreme Court deserves another opportunity to correct this wrong. Under state law, his dissent in Beavers forced the Supreme Court to hear the case. Oral arguments are scheduled for September the 13th. Well, it looks like I'm allowed to spend the remainder of my time on the cultural, artistic endeavors and leave the hard news behind. And let's start with an endeavor starring Yogi Berra. Why not? This is about a movie. Glenn McDonald writes this review of It Ain't Over, which is streaming on select platforms. Yankees great in basketball. Basketball. There we go, John. I'm going to start that again. Yankees great and baseball legend Yogi Berra holds a strange and specific place in American sports culture. Unlike his contemporaries, in the game's Hall of Fame pantheon, Berra is not celebrated for being a conquering hero or elite athlete. Instead, he's remembered as a lovable little guy, a TV ad man, and the inventor of puzzling and occasionally profound sayings known as Yogi-isms. The new documentary, It Ain't Over, dedicated to his overall legacy, has a bone to pick with this assessment. Because according to the numbers, baseball loves numbers, Berra was indeed an elite athlete. And according to pretty much everyone who ever knew him, he was a genuine hero too. Hardcore baseball fans will enjoy all the statistical details presented in the first part of this film, which make a persuasive case for Berra's on-field greatness, but it's the hero business that makes this movie worthwhile for anyone interested in American history and popular culture. By all accounts, Berra really was one of the good guys. A working-class kid from St. Louis, he declined his initial baseball contract to enlist in the Navy during World War II, earning a Purple Heart during the invasion of Normandy, but never filed the paperwork because he didn't want to worry his mother. In 1947, Berra was one of the few white ball players who went out of their way to welcome Jackie Robinson to the major leagues. Late in his career, he signed on to support LGBT equality in sports. He stayed happily married to his high school sweetheart, Carmen, for 65 years, mentored young players, and treated everyone with respect. Like Yankees lifer Don Mattingly says, he was just a gentle, kind soul. That's why he was so loved. With hagiographic salutes like this film, it's typical to pack the frame with people saying nice things about the subject, but you can't fake the genuine affection shown here by dozens of baseball insiders and celebrity fans. Derek Jeter, Billy Crystal, Vin Scully, Mariana Rivera, Willie Randolph, Susan Waldman. Even President Obama makes an appearance in a bit of archival footage. It's heartwarming, all right, but the most intriguing parts of this documentary explore the weird and wonderful phenomenon of Yogi-isms. That title itself is based on Berra's most famous saying, "It ain't over till it's over," which, according to the film, he may not have actually said. It seems that many of the folksy malapropisms now ascribed to Berra were misattributed or penned by copywriters during Berra's post-baseball career in TV commercials. That's a little depressing, but plenty of the more famous ones have been fully vetted, and they're the best ones anyway. For example, there's Yogi's famous counsel about dining out. Nobody goes to that restaurant anymore. It's too crowded. This is an ideal Yogi-ism. It doesn't make sense, and it makes perfect sense at the same time. Poets spend years chasing a maneuver like this. Baseball guru Bob Costas, holding forth in his usual, slightly aggravating way, busts out another classic. Always go to other people's funerals, otherwise they won't go to yours. My personal favorite. When you come to a fork in the road, take it. You can't argue with genius like this. It's American Zen. On the structural level, the director, Sean Mullen, doesn't break any new ground. The doc has the usual mix of archival with talking head interviews and makes no attempt to illuminate any darkness around its exalted subject. We learn that Berra had a slight temper, maybe. But that's fine. This film is a celebration, not an investigation. It does what it sets out to do, providing context and insight into one of the great characters in American sports history. You should never meet your heroes, the saying goes, but with Yogi Berra, you're perfectly safe. Another earlier article that I don't believe I had a chance to read on prior weeks, June 14th, by Lena Geller, about Mia Castillo Marte's Creative Repair pop-up. The clues are everywhere. There's a wicker basket full of cloth, books about leather and fabric stacked and bound with a dark green belt, and a woman with a measuring tape around her neck who, to pass the time, is threading a needle through the holes of button-shaped sugar cookies. Still, the people who approach the newest tent at the Durham Craft Market at the end of May seem to have tunnel vision for the clothing rack. They peruse its small collection of shirts, vests, and jackets before realizing that all of the items are in disrepair. One person asks, "Is this a new young person thing?" Eyeing a brown leather jacket with a hole in the sleeve. "Technically, yes. Mia Castillo Marte, who soft launched the Creative Repair pop-up several hours earlier, is 35. The service she is offering, though, is an ancient one. Castillo Marte specializes in mending wearables and home furnishings. If a customer brings in an item that's an easy fix, a blouse with a missing button, say, or pants with a broken belt loop, Castillo Marte can do it on the spot at Creative Repair, a weekly gig she launched on May the 20th at the Durham Craft Market, which takes place next to the Durham Farmers Market downtown. For more intensive repairs, she'll take an item home and bring it back to the market in a week or two, or drop it off at the designated location. She can also do house calls for larger projects like armchairs or ottomans. Other items are welcome, too. Castillo Marte loves a good challenge, she says, and if she doesn't know how to fix something, she probably knows someone who does. Pricing varies by item. But Castillo Marte says on-site fixes typically range from $5 to $15 and take-home repairs average between $30 and $50. She also offers multiple price options for a given item. If a customer just wants an item to be functional again, they can opt for a lower price. If they want a more comprehensive restoration, they can pay more. The pop-up grew out of Castillo Marte's disillusionment with the retail industry. After graduating from Fashion Institute of Technology in New York in 2010, she worked several jobs centered around the mass production of private label products, which are manufactured by third parties for brands like Charlotte Russe and H&M. She says, "I was in the part of the process of bringing hundreds of thousands of units worth of crap into the United States. A lot of bubbles were burst for me. There's that saying, if a tree falls down in the middle of the woods, it doesn't make a sound. It's kind of like that when it comes to clothes. There have been scandals internationally about factories that have completely collapsed and killed 1,000 people. But brands continue exploiting people to keep their costs low." She was also appalled by the level of overproduction and waste she witnessed. She'd always wanted a Burberry trench coat, for instance, but when she realized that the brand does things like burn surplus stock to prevent its luxury goods from being sold at a discounted rate, that fantasy also died. After several years in the industry, Castillo Marte moved to Durham and ended up taking a job at local shop Wyatt and Dad Cobbler Company. Nearly every time she fixed something at the shop, shoes, a baby stroller, an umpire's chest protector, customers would light up. And she says, "Seeing how much these objects meant to people kind of changed my direction, or my redemption, if you will. Getting things repaired takes time and money, and fast fashion especially has made it easier to throw something out than put a few stitches in it. But after seeing people react to my repairs at the shop, I realized the key is tying objects to memories." Several months ago, she left her job at the shop to pursue creative repair. Beyond providing a repair service and educating customers on troublesome retail industry customs, Castillo Marte says the pop-up aims to encourage people to tell the stories of the silent heroes that live in our closets. We cannot simply discard everything and replace it with something brand new that's likely of lesser quality when so many of these things have value to us beyond their use. Ultimately, she says, I want to create a repair revolution. On her first market day, a handful of Castillo Marti's friends drop off clothing at the Creative Repair tent. Most items get hung on the rack, but when one friend delivers a pair of platform wedges with a broken strap and a peeling sole, Castillo Marti jumps into action. She talks her friend through a few different repair variations and whips out her emergency mending kit, a small plastic case full of needles, seam rippers, bread clips, which she repurposes as spools, and other tools she often helps to help strangers with wardrobe malfunctions on the fly. I presume that means on the go. With a tiny pair of Japanese scissors, she then cuts down the elastic on that broken strap and quickly torches it with a lighter to prevent any fraying. She didn't bring her full toolkit along for the soft launch, but once home, she says she'll patch that strap with leather and cement the sole down with shoe glue. After that, she goes to examine the other items her friends have dropped off, a burgundy vest with frayed armholes, a red blazer with a torn lining, and a pair of jeans with a hole in the pocket. She says fabric is so forgiving. I think that's why they call it the fabric of life. When you make mistakes, there's always a way to fix it. Now I have time for a Sarah Edwards column written this week. About Long Relief, a music release from Triangle First. Premiering today on the indie website, No Growth, the title track on Long Relief's forthcoming debut EP, tells a story that matches its name. Lead singer Paul Blessed intones, I don't want my life to change. I'm getting older every day. I don't want to stick my neck out. I just like to talk about it, even when I don't do crap. It's classic garage rock with angst enmeshed in swirling guitars, the propulsive rhythm section, and the whole song is propulsive, really. High energy and hard punching as it blasts through slacker purgation. There's a dynamic tension on No Growth between wanting and doing that feels like it fits the anxiety of the moment and earns its place on late-night summer driving playlists. And despite the declarations of the chorus, by the end of the song, catharsis has been found on the other side. Based in the triangle, No Relief is Paul Blessed, Chris Carr, Jeremiah Sloop, and Greg Hughes. The band has been playing consistent live shows in the Triangle for a year and gets a real boost later this summer when its summer lineup leads all the way to a September slot at Hopscotch. Long Relief cites the Weaker Thans, Superchunk, and classic 80s-90s college rock as influences, and they shine through on the forthcoming No Growth EP, which was tracked at the tail end of 2022 at the Sandwich Shop, and it releases on June the 9th. This column was written in May, and so it has released. But if you go to IndieWeek.com, presumably you'll be able to hear that one track, apparently for free, if they still have that up. Long Reliefs, No Growth. I will begin a small experiment now, reading some individual choices that I have to make myself because there's nobody to tell me, from the Indie Week calendar. Now, independent Indie Week often maintained an exhaustive calendar of events, lectures, concerts, movies, what have you. And that has gotten a resurgence after the COVID pandemic. In their online issue now, particularly, since we don't see very much of the print edition. So, enough jabber. I'm going to just read a few things out over that encompass the next week, because there'll be another one in the following. So, let's get going on that. I'll just add that it's up to you to go to IndieWeek.com and find more about venues and ticket prices. I can't give all that information, but here's just a few from each day, beginning on Saturday, I believe, June the 24th. Objects from a Parallel Dimension, a multidisciplinary show by Charlie Dupuis at the Horace Williams House. There's a Pocket Prairie Walk at Sarah Duke Gardens at 9 a.m. There is, of course, the right now going on at the Raleigh Convention Center, Brick Universe. That's a Lego fan expo, and that's going on for several days. There's an Elmo meet and greet at Little Doodles Play Cafe in Wakefield. There's an introduction for women to stand-up paddleboarding at Falls Lake and Durham, 9:30 in the morning on Saturday. And let's see, I'm scrolling down here like you'll be able to do. Family Farm Animal Day over at Duke Homestead State Historic Site at 10 a.m. A Balloon Bash Scavenger Hunt at Moore Square, 10:30 a.m. in Raleigh. We have an Independent Animal Rescue Dog Adoption Event. That's at Sunny Acres Pet Resort, Saturday at 12:30. Sunday in Raleigh, 10 a.m., Spiders, Fear to Fascination at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. You get West Point on the Eno, gives you park tours at 10 a.m. Sunday. And a jazz brunch at Alley 26 at 10:30, featuring Al Strong Presents Jazz Brunch. There is a lobster truck at the Botanist and Barrel. That's at 1 p.m., and a poetry workshop series at Eno River Farmers Market Pavilion, Sunday at 1 p.m. If you're interested in riding the cyclone, there's the Arts Center at 2:30 p.m., Ride the Cyclone. There's a gospel musical called Crowns at the Durham Arts Council at 3. And at 4, the Vocal Arts Ensemble at Durham and their annual summer concert. That's in Duke Chapel. American Dance Festival Faculty and Musicians Concert at 5 p.m. at the Reynolds Industries Theater. And easing in our beloved musicians telling me that I must stop reading to you from Indie Week, and that if you want to see any more of these articles that I've read or articles that may have missed, you can go yourself to IndieWeek.com and find them, including this huge calendar which lists events. I mean, probably a couple hundred in there, and I only got to tell you about 10 or 11 of them. I'll try to do more of that, time permitting, in future weeks. In the meantime, John Federson is going to bid you good day for this edition of Indie Week.